That little beauty was Riggins Higgins from Rachel Cohen's debut album, Halftime, which is on Whirlwind Records. Rachel Cohen is an alto saxophone player from, well, I won't tell you where she's from because it'll ruin the episode. But she's a saxophone player, and her interview starts around the 9-minute mark of this show. So if you just want to get straight to us talking to her about her life, then you can skip to 9 minutes. But if you want to listen to the dulcet tones of me and Dan and the news and anything else that's going on first, then don't skip forwards, because if I may be so bold, it's time for the Jazz Podcast.
Jazz Podcast. In conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello and welcome to the Jazz Podcast. It's episode 21 today. Yes, I've done my research and I know what show number it is.
I wouldn't really call that doing research, looking up on Buzzsprout what number we're on.
Well, because I never normally know. I thought that was quite a nice touch. Start the show informed.
Sure.
Sure.
Well, yeah, what's going on, Rob?
I am just thinking.
Enjoying your freedom.
Yeah, enjoying some freedom from school. Going to interview Barak Shmuel today.
Oh, right. For the what's film. That
for? For the Richard Turner
film,
which would be cool. I'm keeping the film interviews and the podcast sort of mutually exclusive because it's quite a lot to ask to do two in one day. Not for me, more for the the poor victim in question in this case.
Poor soul that has to talk to you for over 2 hours.
Exactly. Nobody's going to do that. So, that's the one. Let's do some news. There is two news items, both of them conveniently closely linked to the Jazz Podcast. The first is that actually there can be three, because right now the number of listens we're getting per week is absolutely through the ceiling.
What are we up to?
It's very high. Without giving anyone any ideas, because I'd like them to jump to their own conclusions, you know, about how many millions per week we're currently going through. I tell you what I will do, though. I will read out the last 10 episodes, the percentage of them that have been listened in various continents, so that you can get an idea. So in the last 10 shows, which, because that's the most I can do at once. Wow. Guess what our top city is?
Top city.
And it's not London.
I don't know. Tokyo.
Yes! Absolutely unbelievable. It's Tokyo.
I was looking at the stats. I'm sorry. I think today that, Rob. You thought I'd get started.
Wow.
You got very excited there.
Wow.
That's mad, isn't it?
Like, he's Tokyo. A genius. This is incredible. 64% of our plays in Europe, 16% in Asia, 4% in Australia.
So why is someone in Tokyo listening to our podcast?
Who knows? It's still Loz's show, man. People are, that show's had like 100 listens this week. The king of the podcast is becoming more and more untouchable. And then we have
California.
California. There's a lot. When they say Australia, they also mean New Zealand, because I know we have a few listeners there. Who will be deeply upset to know that statistical analysis clumps them all together under the banner of Australia. And then 1% Africa, 0% South America, but we have had 5 plays. And 15% North America.
There you go.
There you go indeed. So the news was as follows. Lauren Kinsella is playing at the Vortex on Sunday with Kit Downs. They're playing the music of Paul Motion. And before their set, James Madron is playing a drum solo set.
Right.
Not like one drum, you know, like a drum kit.
Plural solo drums. Set.
Plural of drums. Solos. They're doing a little UK tour. Going to see them at the Jazz, Manchester Jazz Festival next week. A gig which we previewed in our Manchester Jazz Festival preview show.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. So, yeah, the Vortex on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Lauren Kitt and James Madron. So a triple way jazz podcast alumnus gig. Yeah, big time. And the other one is about our entrance music, our beloved Gareth Le Crane.
Is he playing?
Gareth, his new album is coming out.
Oh, right. Does that mean we're going to get a new soundtrack?
Possibly. That's an interesting idea.
We only exclusively use Gareth Le Crane tracks.
Exactly. That any music you've heard at the start of any of the shows, video shows or audio shows, is always Gareth on the flute. So his big band album, Fist Fight at the Barn Dance, is finished.
That's a great title.
Some beauty. The album cover is absolutely fantastic as well. It's just a fist fight, but there's instruments and silhouettes, and it's a real beauty.
Right.
His album's coming out on the 25th of August on Whirlwind Records. And the album launch is the 11th of September at King's Place. Incredible.
Great.
Yeah.
Very good.
Big time. So that will be cool. We shall listen to it. This was supposed to be the summer of the jazz podcast, but I think it's become accidentally the summer of Whirlwind Records because everyone I speak to is on that label at the moment.
All right, okay.
Including Rachel Cohen. So let's talk to her now.
Oh, nice segue.
Yeah.
Very good segue.
That was stunning. Oh, I'm so getting into this, man. I can't wait for you to hear some of my my plugging skills, and the way everything ties together at the end of this show is marvelous. Mm. Before we start, I'm going to issue one warning to the listeners, and that is that Rachel has absolutely no idea about internet connection speeds and how they are affected by going outdoors for a cigarette.
Okay.
So there's about 30 seconds where it just full on drops out now and then.
Yeah. You didn't edit that out? Or
I tried, but it's quite funny to still hear the mumbles, and you can hear the odd word, and you can also hear some, like, some background noise. It's a real adventure. I thought it was actually more of a journey with all that noise in. You really feel like you're there with her. So there is a bit of weirdness. And then when I realize she's outside, it all calms down a bit. So all in all, I give this interview B-.
Yeah.
Could have been better.
Well, you're rating yourself really there, aren't you, Rob? Let's be honest.
Yeah, that's a self-rating. That's no reflect on Rachel.
You're not rating Rachel.
No, not at all.
That would be a bit rude.
Oh, man, she's just given up her time to talk to us. We're insanely lucky. My performance warrants a B-. So let's hope in the next few shows we can really up the game a little bit, you know.
Mm.
Sweet. Okay. Well,
let these poor people find the episode.
Here she comes, Rachel Cohen. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in the very north of Scotland in the Shetland Islands.
Wow. Can you see the northern lights there?
Yes, you can. You can see a lot of crazy out there. It's really like it's an incredibly beautiful place. I lived on the coast. I lived next to the beach in a very, 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 very small. I don't know if you even pass as the title village.
Wow. Do you know how many people lived there?
So Shetland's like made up of like lots of islands. The mainland, I think population total max is about 25,000 people, if that. So it's a really, really small place. I went to a junior high school, and which involved going to nursery there, then primary school, and then secondary school up to the age where you could leave at 16, because you can leave school at 16 in Scotland. So,
right.
And that entire education thing at that school was only 300 people,
wow,
as in pupils, you know, so it was like really, really, really small.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, and then after that, but actually, I mean, like, Shetland's great. What it's really good for, people always say, God, you must have been so isolated. I'm like, yeah, I was, but, they're, music system is really great.
Yeah.
Their music is amazing up there. You know, my mom was a music teacher. you know, all of that kind of stuff. Their folk music scene up there is crazy good. Man. Crazy good, you know. So there's some like really talented people up there. You know, it's actually really, really cool up there. So I was quite lucky. And then when I was 12, I moved to Edinburgh after that.
Yeah.
I moved to Edinburgh when I was 12. And I went to the City of Edinburgh Music School, which is like a music school attached to just a state school, basically.
Right.
And that was pretty great.
Yeah.
That was pretty great.
How long were you there for then? How long were you there for?
I was there until I left school. So I started there when I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
And then I left there when I was about 19.
And did you go as a principal study? Like, how does the saxophone fit in with this
stuff? Well, so by this point, I was already playing piano. So I started playing piano when I was about 4.
Mm-hmm.
So I've always played the two in tandem, really. You know, I started playing the saxophone when that was the thing about growing up in an island is you have a very kind of, not a shortage, but a very small kind of amount of variation in instruments, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So I got offered to play either the fiddle, you know, the violin, or the saxophone. So me being my 8-year-old self went, I'll have the shiny one,
yeah.
please.
Of course.
You know, and there weren't really that many other people playing it.
Yeah.
You know, there were, but they were so spread out over the island, you know, that it's not like somebody else in your school plays saxophone, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's like somebody else in another school quite far away will maybe play saxophone. Do you know what I mean? It's like that kind of...
Two ferries away.
Yeah. You know what I mean? So a boat ride and then some. So, you know, I got into that like that. And in the main kind of the capital of Shetland, Lerwick, there was a Saturday morning music club that my mum actually used to run. And a couple of other people, you know, they had a little classical music band and then they had a jazz band, a wind band, all of that kind of stuff. So that's when I started like reading like charts.
Yeah.
And do you know what I mean? Like, so you do the kind of wind band stuff, but then you throw in like, you know, a couple of big band charts. And then, of course, there was a big band. So once you were starting reading that stuff, then you got into the big bands. And do you know what I mean? It was kind of that kind of development on that. So by the time I got to Edinburgh, I'd already done like quite a few grades and, you know, all that kind of usual stuff. And I was already reading great, you know. So, you know, there were loads of offers. By the time I was in Edinburgh, you know, there was loads going on, reading, playing and everything, you know, and I was still playing piano. So, but really, when I got to Edinburgh, it was definitely a dual study for me.
Yeah.
You know, but on two completely different music genres. You know, like I was doing the classical saxophone to get through my grades and everything, but really I knew if I was going to play the saxophone, I wanted to be a jazz player.
Right.
You know, because by that point, you know, that when you're in Shetland as well, there's lots of people that come up to the islands and give workshops and gigs and do all this kind of stuff. So I'd had my full, like, 5-piece jazz orchestra, I think was like the first big one for me in Shetland anyway. They would come up and, you know, you know,
yeah.
So I was kind of set on what I wanted to do with the saxophone, really, by that point. But then the piano, I was definitely like classical music. You know, but when you go to the nice thing about the music school in Edinburgh was that it's.
Are you outside, Rachel?
I am outside. Yeah, sorry. I'm having a cigarette. Yeah, sorry. It's a bit of a complicated situation, actually. I've lost my keys.
I've
lost my keys. But I had to take my rubbish out and go for a cigarette. So I'm having to kind of like hold the door shut. Yeah, sorry. The rubbish man was just going past. Sorry, guys.
I thought that, so. That's amazing.
It's really funny. I always stand on the phone with my headphones in, so I don't necessarily hear the background noise.
Yeah.
Maybe as heavily as our listeners will.
Yeah, everyone's getting a right earful with that bin truck. Yeah. It's gone now, though. It's fine.
Yeah, it's gone now. It's gone now.
Just go back again and tell me what it was. What was it, something you'd heard to like be like, I want to be a jazz saxophone player? Like, how did that become the thing that you knew you didn't want to be, like a contemporary classical player?
Sure. Well, I mean, I definitely hadn't heard any contemporary, thank God, by that point. So there was nothing, I hadn't been jaded by
right,
that.
Okay.
But, I mean, for me, really, I think it was probably those people coming up to the end. So, like, there was, like, Phil Bancroft, I remember, came up to Shetland once and gave me a lesson when I was a kid, actually. He's a really great saxophone player, Scottish saxophone player. And, you know, and then after that, it was really the Fife Youth Jazz Orchestra coming up, actually. There was a guy called Jim O'Malley, who was a tutor on that course, who was a really, really great player amongst everybody else. And it was also seeing the other kids that were just a little bit older than me playing all this stuff that I couldn't play yet.
Yeah.
You know, and it sounded wicked. You know, it just sounded amazing. Just like big band charts and people taking solos and this kind of stuff. I was like, whoa, like... You know, I hadn't really heard it en masse like that from a look. Do you know what I mean? Because you didn't really get it up in Shetland like that.
Yeah.
You know, you had a condensed, you know, you, do you know what I mean? You had a few people here and there, but to see that whole band of really cool kids come up and do this whole thing, you know, and then be taking solos and doing all this stuff, I was like, wow. That,
yeah.
That is really cool. And then, of course, people give you recordings of stuff, you know. Somebody gives you the Omni book when you're a kid and you're like, who's this Parker guy? Like, you know what I mean? You know, so you know, things like that. And then, I mean, early on, really, I mean, it's Parker for me, you know, once I was in it, you know, it was that kind of thing, you know, it was those kind of influences. It wasn't necessarily, you know, somebody gave me a Train record when I was 9 and that was it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really like that for me in a lot of ways, you know, because... it was more just seeing the opportunity, and because I always had an affinity for the music. I mean, I must have heard some jazz and records and stuff when I was younger, but I grew up on a lot of different music. You know, neither of my parents are jazz musicians, even though my mum's a musician. She wasn't specifically a jazz musician, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean.
What did she do as a musician?
So my mum was actually a classical piano player when she was younger, but she trained in woodwind. She was clarinet player and a fabulous singer, you know, so she was not a jack of all trades, but she was very capable with a lot of different things. But really, she was her best as a singer, really, and clarinet player.
Yeah.
So she would lead like choirs. She would do loads of, do you know what I mean? She would lead loads of the bands at schools. And do you know what I mean? She was like a great like musical director as well, you know. So she was always like heavily involved in like the bigger bands, shows, all of this kind of stuff that was going on.
Yeah.
At schools and wherever, you know, so... Mm.
So then, was there a moment when you were like, how did you decide this was going to be your career?
Well, the City of Edinburgh Music School, I mean, they prepare you like thoroughly,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, like for me, I don't know, actually, I don't think I really ever had that moment. I mean, I was saying they prepared me for what I was going to be doing. I knew that that's what I was going to be doing anyway. That's why I went there.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. You know, for me, it was always just, yeah, I'm another one. I never really had that moment. That was just kind of it.
Right.
If you know what I mean. Since I was a kid, it was like, well, that's that then. I never really considered, I mean, I suppose maybe, I mean, I come from quite a musical family as well. My sister trained as a musician. She's a trombone player. You know, and that was my mum's career. And my mum's brothers as well were also musicians,
yeah.
successful musicians, you know. So for me, it just kind of was like, well, that's obviously what I'm doing,
yeah.
playing all these instruments and doing this stuff. So I'll just keep doing this.
Great.
You know what I mean? It was definitely that. And obviously you get older and you start thinking about it a bit more seriously when you realize you might be poor for the rest of your life, and yeah. you consider all of those things. And also, I mean, I think actually the hardest bit for me was when I had to kind of knuckle down on one instrument more than the other. That was quite yeah. hard for me, actually, you know, because it was definitely an opportunity for me to go very far with piano, like
yeah.
really far. And actually, a turning point for me with that was when I left school. I'd had the same piano teacher for such a long time, and And I really loved her, actually, a pianist called Linda Cochran. She's incredible. She plays for the, well, at the time she was playing for the Royal Scottish Ballet, and she was doing all sorts of crazy projects. She was always going to America, doing loads of, you know, film score sessions, doing all this stuff. You know, she was like an idol for me when I was younger, you know, amazing. So when I went to Birmingham, they gave me second study lessons on piano, but I didn't like the teacher.
Right.
And it kind of put a little downer on it for me.
Yeah.
You know, and then I realized maybe that actually wasn't the avenue that I wanted to pursue for the rest of my life.
Right.
You know, and the scene that I was really fully in on the saxophone and doing that whole thing was definitely taking the lead for me.
Ah,
you know,
okay.
So it kind of gradually just worked its way out that way, really. There were a couple of little pointers that I went, yeah, I think it's going to be. Because, I mean, obviously I'd auditioned to go to Birmingham to play the saxophone, but they just knew I was a really good piano player and that I would want to keep that up,
yeah.
You know, which I did. Yeah. But really, yeah, it was the saxophone just kind of got the better of me. Like,
nice.
You know? Yeah, it kind of worked out like that.
And you were there on the jazz course at Birmingham?
Yeah, yeah. I started there in 2006.
Mm-hmm. Your bin, Laurie's been replaced by children.
Oh yeah, right. There's a little school trip going past. Maybe I should smoke slightly quicker.
The jazz podcasts have often been strange, but this one feels like a real day in the life of.
Yeah. Do you know what? This is where I live as well. Do you know Green Lanes in Haringey?
Yeah, I used to live in Tottenham.
Right. Yeah, Green Lanes is always just like bustling with some sort of madness.
Yeah.
Which would include this.
I think, yeah, there was a bus that used to go from my place past Green Lanes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can't remember what it was now, but it definitely had three. It was like a 280 or there was.
Oh, was it the 29?
Oh, yeah, that was a great one. The 29 was a real workhorse.
Oh, yeah, it's a real party bus. Uh-huh. And the N29 goes from Soho as well, so you get that bus from Ronnie's.
Yeah.
All the way back to here. Yeah, it's nice. A bit of a crazy hang on that bus sometimes.
Yeah, bet it is.
Mm-hmm.
On my stag do, I got the night bus home. And
oh, wow, really?
Yes, yeah, I don't know what I was thinking, but I was like, oh, just get on the night bus. And it was fine. It wasn't back to Tottenham, actually. I lived in Twickenham, so it was a very civilised night bus.
Right, right.
But I needed the toilet so bad I had to get off and then wait for the next bus. Took me ages to get home. That was a really impractical way of travelling around.
Yeah, everybody's had their fair share of bad night bus experiences. Because the problem is... Well, I mean, the N29, if you have a few too many of Ronnie's and then you fall asleep, you will end up in Enfield.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I reckon more people are sick on the buses north of the river as well.
Yeah, quite possibly. It gets a bit rowdy up north.
It certainly does.
Yeah, a little bit.
So we'll come back to Green Lanes because we can have some fun. But
indeed.
Just so I don't miss anything, who are you getting taught by when you're in Birmingham?
So my main teacher was Mike Williams,
mm-hmm.
The alto teacher there, incredible player. Incredible guy. Jean Toussaint was there and is still there.
Oh, cool.
And Julian Siegel was there as well. I mean, in my first 2 years, it was really Mike. I actually had more lessons with him than anybody else,
mm-hmm.
definitely in the first 2 years. In my third and fourth year, I spent more time with Julian Siegel, actually.
Yeah.
With little bits here and there with Jean. And they're great. I mean, they're amazing teachers. You know, really amazing people. Mike Williams is still there at Birmingham. They were really great. And then, I mean, the teachers that were there were great. I mean, Phil Robson was still there. Liam Noble was teaching there. Jeff Williams was teaching there. Tony Levin, bless him, when he was around, he was teaching there. And there's amazing teachers at Birmingham, actually, when I was there. Yeah, amazing group of people, yeah. Mm-hmm. Hans Koller as well. He's still there, but he was teaching there. He was our composition teacher for a long time.
Cool. And
yeah, it was really great, actually. I mean, the people that came over as well were amazing. You know, like we got to do some really some really great stuff at Birmingham. Yeah, some really great stuff.
Was the Dave Holland visiting artist thing?
Yes. Yeah. So I think he'd done that. Yeah, I think he was doing that for the first time while I was there. Actually, he came over. I didn't do his groups the first time around, but then the second time around, he did this thing where he would send over a bunch of his music for about two or three groups, I think.
Right.
You know, you'd learn all the music before he got there, and then he'd come in and workshop the whole thing with you, and you'd do a gig playing all of his music, and it was really cool, man. I mean, like, yeah, such a nice guy as well.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Dave is, like, he was always, like, really peaceful guy, you know, would always come in super encouraging and, you know, a lot of fun as well, you know, like, he was really, really, really great. And he would always just play such a lot as well, you know, like, he was never, you know, as if he'd be shy, but he never shied away from, like, he was always just right in there, you know, like, really involved with what we were doing with the music. And, you know, it was really cool. And then he would be around for other things as well. You know, like, he would, if he was around, he would come in and you know, like, so I remember playing in a band, you know, playing some of my music and other people's music, and he would workshop your music, you know, which was great.
That sounds awesome. Know? Yeah.
And he took a couple of tunes away. I remember he took one of my tunes away, and some other people's tunes, you know, to take to kids that he was teaching at the new school.
Nice. That's,
you know,
really
so
cool.
He would take your compositions away and work with some other kids over there doing your stuff. And, you know, it's like, he was really, like, yeah, really great. Dave was, like, really, yeah, quite inspirational to have around, considering, you know, the magnitude of his kind of status, you know, like, he was really, you know, you didn't always feel that when he was there, if you know what I mean, just because he was so sweet, you know, he was just so great. Yeah. Yeah, he was amazing. But we had amazing people come up. We had a great session with John Hollenbeck once, actually. John Hollenbeck had his trio with Theo Blackman and Gary Versace.
Mm-hmm.
And they came over. Have you ever heard any of John Hollenbeck's big band music?
No.
Wow, man.
I know.
Like, it's intense. It's intense music, you know. So we had exactly the same thing. He sent over all of his big band stuff. And who was in that band then? Me and Alex Merritt, you know Alex Merritt?
Yeah.
And, you know, we were doing all, like, the main saxophone parts. And, yeah, it was really crazy, you know. Because Theo Blackman does this whole thing. Like, he's a total, like, serious vocalist, you know, in terms of, like, the voice as an instrument kind of thing. He had all these little gizmos and stuff with him, and it was an amazing concert, you know, and, like, it was really incredible.
Yeah,
because it wasn't, like, I remember him saying, you know, he was like, I don't want it to sound like jazz so much, you know, like the horns were having to do a really textural part, you know. It was really, like, intense work on that music, actually, to get it right. It was amazing, you know, those opportunities to do that. And Mike Gibbs, you know Mike Gibbs?
Yes, indeed.
Mike Gibbs was another one. He was
a
total fellow of the conservatory.
Right.
You know, like, he was there a lot. We did a lot of big band stuff.
Because
I was lead alto in the big band for pretty much the whole time I was there, I seem to remember.
Wow.
You know, and he came over and did loads. We did quite a few concerts with Mike, actually.
Yeah.
Doing all his arrangements. And we did a great concert with him and Christine Tobin.
Nice.
Yeah, there was some really, really cool stuff with him, actually. He was amazing, you know. And he taught, and he did some composition classes with people when he was around. And yeah, we were lucky at Birmingham, actually. We were really lucky at Birmingham. John Taylor, bless him, was still there as well. John Taylor was teaching for quite a long time there, you know. Yeah, we had a really lucky time of it at Birmingham, actually. When I think back to it, you know, we had some amazing things happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
But then, unsurprisingly, there's loads of great young players that have come from Birmingham because of the standard of the education they offered, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's some amazing people. I mean, like Tim Thornton, you know, I'm just thinking from my group, Tim was the year below me, Tim Thornton, Chris Draper, you know, Louis Mather, Kieran McIntosh, like, there's loads of loads of, I mean, even not on the jazz course. I mean, Laura Mvula came from Birmingham.
Yeah.
You know, and her brother as well was at college at the same time as me, amazing cellist, you know.
Yeah, was just Richard really... Foote there when you were there?
Yes, yeah. Yes. my old friend Richard Foote, man. Yeah. I love that guy.
Oh, amazing.
But yeah, you know, but the thing is, actually, I mean, I look at Birmingham now and I think the scene is probably stronger there than it has been for quite a long time, actually. Yeah.
Richard, when I talked to him, and Johnny Silk as well, they seem to be doing stuff.
Doing stuff. That is very true. They're great. I mean, they actually have a little...
They have a radio show, don't they?
Brum Radio? Yeah, they have their own little radio station where they you know, talk about the scene there and play other people's records, which is great as well. You know, they'll always have a little record feature. I'm pretty sure they have my record on there one time. You know, like they're really making moves there, definitely, because they were running the Spotted Dog. You must have played the Spotted Dog.
I know of it. I've never played there.
Yeah, that's a great venue. That really kicked off when I was at college. I actually used to work there. I used to work behind the bar there.
Oh, wow, because that's still going, isn't it? There's still like a monthly gig.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's like Next Generation now. Yeah. It's a trumpet player called Sean Gibbs,
right?
Who runs that now, and it was Richard and, well, we call him Silky, Jonathan Silk. But it started out with Mike Fletcher,
the alto saxophone player.
He's
studying in Birmingham at the moment, isn't he? He's doing a PhD.
I think he might well be. Yeah, he might well be
a PhD in composition.
Yeah, wow.
And he lives in Spain.
Yes, really, well, this is the thing, I think. And he's travelled a lot around Europe from what I can tell. And he's, you know, compositionally, he's been writing for all sorts of different projects, you know. So, yeah, I mean, Mike's great. Great. He was one of the great ones to come out of Birmingham, you know, as a player. Really amazing. Yeah.
If you go on... brumradio.com, you can listen to all of the shows that they do. They're all on like catch up.
Nice.
It's really cool. So if you're bored of the jazz podcast, by all means
flip over.
Exactly. That is really cool.
It's great that they do that. I mean, I suppose that's the way, isn't it, the podcast thing, and you know, the radio stations.
Yeah, just helping people to find out what it even is to look for, to listen to, you know.
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think when people can get to know your personality, they're more likely to like your music.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing with where jazz can be difficult sometimes, you know. There is that whole kind of, some people have really kind of, you know, steered away from the word jazz, because it, for a lot of people, has an association that they either don't feel is relevant to them anymore, or, you know, it puts people off in some way, you know, like it can't be, you know, jazz isn't, I mean, it is changing now, but it's changing within a very specific kind of fields, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, I was about to say it doesn't appeal to the younger people, but it does in some senses. You know, you have lots of hip hop artists now, you know, using jazz, you know, as a part of their thing, which does appeal to the people listening to it. But, you know, it's one of those things. So, but I think, you know, for people actually looking to get into the music at all, you know, then, you know, it needs to be publicized properly, and podcasts and that kind of stuff have definitely got to be the way to do it, you know, and get things out there. And definitely.
So what made you decide to move to London? When did you move to London?
So I moved to London at the start of 2012. 12, is that right? Start 2012? Yeah. Is that right? I always get confused. I forget something. It's either 2012 or 2013. I think it's 2012. Because I'd done my record with Whirlwinds.
Yeah.
So I got kind of headhunted, maybe, if that's what you call it.
Yeah.
By Mike Janish,
Yes.
Who's somebody that I'd known for quite a long time anyway. When Mike moved over here from the States, I was in Tommy Smith's youth orchestra.
Yeah.
And Tommy always had guest in with the band and all this kind of stuff. And Mike was one of those people. I think he did the Edinburgh Jazz Festival with us one year or something. And then after that, once I'd moved to Birmingham, he then just kept popping up, you know, with all the artists that were coming over, you know, so like George Garzon, people like that, you know, he was just playing bass for, you know, on their kind of tours and everything, you know, so they would stop in at Birmingham and I just kept seeing him like that, you know, and eventually he contacted me. Oh yeah, he was doing Donny McCaslin's tour as well. He did the thing with Phil Robson, Donny McCaslin, who was on drums that, Dave Smith and Mike. They did this incredible quartet.
Yeah.
And yeah, so after that, Mike basically, this is the power of social media, I actually got a message on Twitter saying, you know, how would you be up for recording, you know, and this was a message from a record label, and I didn't realize it was Mike's label that he'd actually set up.
Oh,
you know,
so I got cool.
this mystery message.
Yeah.
You know, and it turns out to be that, and the label was very small at that point. Mike had set up that label to release his own music, and then obviously realized, you know, he could potentially do a lot more with it, which he has done incredibly well. So he got me on board when the label was about maybe 2 years old, 2 or 3 years old. And I recorded at the end of 2012. Oh yeah, do you know what? I must have moved to London in 2013. That's right. So I recorded at the end of the 2012.
Yeah.
And then moved at the beginning of 2013. That's it.
So what made you move exactly? Like,
well, basically, I mean, I was kind of done with Birmingham anyway. I'd graduated in 2010.
Yeah. A four-year course.
It was a 4-year course. I did 2006, 2010.
So we were the same year then, because that was the...
Oh, right. Yeah. You were at the Academy, right?
I went to the Royal Northern for those four, and then the Masters at Academy, because I wanted to move to London and I wanted to be better.
Right.
And that was kind of a perfect, you know, a match, because I didn't do a jazz course on that undergrad. So I was just not, you know, I'd have been even more... what's the word? Marmalized than I already was.
Marmalized.
That's not the word, but it's the one.
No, but it works. I'm going to use that. I like that. but yeah, I mean, I could see the opportunities kind of coming to me, basically.
Yeah.
And when you're in one place, it wasn't that I didn't have love for Birmingham. You know, it was just. I'd kind of run my course there.
Yeah.
You know, I was kind of done and I was itching really to kind of do something else. A lot of my friends had left as well.
Right.
You know, a lot of my friends had left and, you know.
That was a big thing for me too. Just all my friends came down here. So it was like, I'll go too then.
And then they start asking you, when are you coming down? You know, like, what are you doing? Maybe you should be here. Maybe you should be doing that. And eventually it's like, all right. You know, and that records opportunity came up like, you know, the planets aligned, you know, for that kind of thing. It was just exactly the right moment and exactly the right kind of thing to be going on to kind of enable me to be down there and doing something.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I just went for it. I mean, it was quite difficult. I didn't, you know, I didn't really have a lot of money. I underestimated the kind of, you know, just how difficult it would be, actually. It was really hard when I first moved here because I wasn't studying.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really have a schedule, nor did I have any money to fill the gaps with. I didn't really, you know, it was a bit crazy, really. I mean, and also, you know, I came back. It was almost like a kind of slow release. When I moved to London, I did this record, obviously, that came out. I released it at the first Whirlwind Festival.
What's it called?
It's called Halftime.
Right.
Halftime. Yeah. And it came out. I mean, everybody loved it, thankfully. I mean, God, you know, it went down really, really well. You know, I toured it. It was great, you know. But then after after that, what I found was because I came here on the back of a record, I wasn't really on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, people didn't really know who I was outside of that record to a certain extent. So I didn't really have any gigs, you know, because that record is a very particular sound. It's very modern. It's very, you know, heavily based on my compositions, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, outside of that, like, I love just playing straight ahead. You know, I love doing that whole thing. You know, I feel kind of, you know, I'm heavily into, like, you know, language and this. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a real focus of my playing. But people didn't really realize that that's how I played, because they looked at this record and then they looked at me and was like, who's this girl? And she's got this record out. And, you know, and people presumed that it was really weird, you know, because people presumed that I was doing really well.
Yeah. Loads of people have told me about this. I remember Mike Chillingworth complaining once that people.
Yeah.
It was just stopping, not asking him as much about functions anymore, just assuming people, that he wasn't into it.
That's exactly it. Yeah, exactly it. People presumed that because I had festival gigs and because I had this and because there was loads of publicity about it, I was getting reviews here and there, people just presumed that I had loads of gigs.
Yeah.
So not only did they not give me any gigs, they didn't really get to know me either.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I was really kind of like, wow. So that was about after a year. I was like, wow, I'm actually really struggling here. You know, it was quite difficult. It was really difficult because, again, I didn't have the structure of coming here to study specifically.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have that whole thing, you know, nor did I have a student loan or a...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it was actually quite hard. But obviously, you know, I got there. It was cool, you know. But I suppose that's why I haven't released it. That record for quite a while, you know, because I really had to kind of and get like into the scene properly.
Yeah,
you know, just doing a lot more work, you know, before I would even consider doing another record. I didn't really need one. I just need some gigs. Yeah. So when Phil moved to New York, Phil Robson, that was kind of, you know, run our courses, like touring that music and doing that whole thing, because that was my quartet. It was me, Phil Robson, Mark Lewandowski for really the main part of that quartet. It was Cam Gurley on the records, and Jim Bashford, one of my closest friends from Birmingham, another amazing musician, drummer, to come out of Birmingham, you know. So, you know, I definitely played that music. It's funny, you know, years later, I would actually come back to a lot of that music now, but it would be in a different setting.
Yeah.
It would be in a different thing. But yeah, it was great. I mean, it was a lot of fun, that record. It's quite weird with some records.
Yeah.
I mean, I was the first girl that they'd ever signed to that label as well.
Oh, that's amazing. Good work.
Yeah, you know, so I was the first one. So it's not like there was a lot of pressure. I didn't feel the pressure of that, if you know what I mean. But it was quite interesting, you know, because I mean, like, I'm going to look to record something else, hopefully at the end of this year, you know, just because I feel like I want to now.
Yeah.
You know, and it would go down well. But seeing how the label has transformed, you know, over that time is incredible. It's incredible. Even if you just go to the artist page on Whirlwind.
Yeah.
You know, like, there was just a couple of rows of people of, like, you know, really not even 10 records, I don't think.
Yeah.
Maybe. When I brought mine out, it was so small. It was so, so small. And you go onto it now and it's just like a list as long as your arm, just goes on and on and on. All these incredible people that are releasing, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like, wow. Like, it'll be interesting for me to release something else on that label now in comparison to... You know, because I mean, I recorded that record 5 years ago.
Yeah.
5 years ago, you know. So, yeah, it's great. I'm really happy that it's taken off like that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, amazing.
What was I going to ask you? It's just completely washed out of my brain. Oh, yeah. You're doing like a weekly jazz thing.
Tell us about that. On Kingsland Road, I do a gig every Wednesday at this place called Ray's Bar. which is downstairs from the super hipster pizza joint Voodoo Rays.
Brilliant.
But the pizza is great. But they own, so it's the same people, they own the bar downstairs. And it's this really kooky, dark, neon-lit cocktail bar, basically. And we're the only live thing that they do there. And I do a trio, mainly with Joe Downard on bass and Will Glazer on drums, or yeah. Shane Forbes. I try and keep it, you know, a kind of regular trio that I would work with normally, you know. And we're just there every week. I take my records down. They have a vinyl only set up down there. Because basically the bar is owned by DJs.
Right.
It's really crazy, you know. So they have the most incredible decks and speakers set up, and the whole thing is just amazing. So I go down there and take all my records, all my jazz records down there. And I've become a little jazz DJ.
Sweet, that's amazing.
You know, and then we do some trio sets, and people love it.
That sounds so good.
It's free to get in. It's no entrance fee or anything like that.
Whereabouts in London is this?
So it's 95 Kingsland Road.
Yeah.
Ray's Bar on Kingsland Road. It's just around the corner from the Vortex, 2 minutes walk from the Vortex, from Dawson Kingsland Station. Yeah. Yeah, and it's a really, really great spot. I feel very lucky to be there, actually, because the venue love it. You know,
yeah.
it's I know how hard it can be getting something started anywhere. Yeah. It doesn't matter what city you're in, actually, because it's usually that you are imposing something on a venue and they'll decide when they don't want it anymore. You know, whereas, you know, this venue have really taken it on and tried to, because they've not been open for that long.
Yeah.
They've been open since maybe October, November.
Yeah.
And they've really tried to integrate it into a part of their venue.
Yeah.
So it's a really well-supported night. And I love having people come sit in as well. You know, I love that. We've had some great people, you know, come in and hang out there. And I mean, the only downside is no piano.
Yeah.
No piano, so it's kind of, but guitarists can have their day.
That's good. That's very good for the guitarist, isn't it?
You know, yeah, definitely. You know, it's good fun. And it actually seems to be like a favorite drummer's gig a lot. I get more drummers coming down there than anything else. You know, we had Charles Gould from New York down there last week. Jason Brown's been down a number of times. You know, we've had some really nice hangs down there.
Yeah.
So people of London, come check it out.
Exactly, that's amazing, especially because it's free.
Yeah, it's free.
My
you
God.
Know, and it feels like such a little hidden gem as well.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't expect it to be what it is.
Right.
You know, and the staff are great down there. It's a real nice find, you know, so if you haven't been down,
sounds amazing.
Come and hang out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's my weekly jam. I do that every week and I have a lot of fun doing it. It does amazing things for your playing as well.
Yeah, I bet it does.
Because each feel I love it's my favorite setup. And that's actually the vibe with my new quartet. So I have a new quartet at the moment as well.
Is this the one that's playing at Pizza Express in August?
Yes, it is.
Oh man, I'm all over this. Look at me. Look at me. My media skills.
You're killing it, Rob.
I'm fierce.
But yeah, so my new quartet is with Freddie Gavita,
mm-hmm.
Joe Downard, and Shane Forbes. And it's a cordless quartet because I'm obsessed with playing trio, but after a while I miss that front line kind of camaraderie. You know, I miss that, and I've known Freddie for a long time, actually, for many, many, many years, but we'd never really played together.
Mm-hmm.
We'd never really played together, done any gigs together, and I've had some great people do this lineup with me, you know, on trumpet. You know, Steve Fishwick's done it.
It sounds, sorry to interrupt you, but it sounds like you're making a sandcastle.
Oh, really? Oh, no, we can't have that. Hold on.
What is that?
I don't know. Maybe I was tapping something.
Maybe.
It feels, I was just curious. For me, it feels like, you know, I can't hear any. It's because I've got headphones in. I can't hear anything. Sorry. I think my hearing's getting really bad, but I'm just going to presume that. So I always have headphones in so that I never... So I can actually hear what everybody on the phone is saying. Do you know what I mean? But I fidget, so it could be me tapping. In fact, it was. I was tapping a poster thing. Anyway, you keep me updated to the background.
It's fine. I'm just
I'll
trying
adjust
to,
accordingly.
I'm hanging in there for the listeners, if anyone's still going. So you're telling us about Freddie, which I want to know about this.
So Freddie, I mean, we'd never really gigged together. We've known each other for a very long time. And he's amazing. I mean, Freddie's an incredible player. He's also an incredible guy. We get on brilliantly. You know, he's a really great guy to hang with. So I've kind of settled on him as my kind of partner in crime, you know, for that quartet.
Yeah.
And then Joe Downard and Shane, I mean, me and Shane have played a lot together now over the years that I've been here. He's kind of my main call, really, in terms of the drummers that I work with. But him and Joe Downard play brilliantly together.
Right.
You know, and for me, in a trio or any kind of chordless setting, if your drummer or your bass player is not happy with one or the other, then it's a disaster, really, for me. You know, it has to be, there has to be a complete unit there, you know, and that includes them getting on great, you know. And that makes a huge difference. But really, musically, they just connect amazingly well. And I connect amazingly well with them, you know. So it's really, I mean, it's taken quite a long time. I've kind of shifted that lineup a few times, different bass players, different trumpet players. But I'm really settled on that now, which is why, you know, I'm now getting these gigs kind of in the book to really push that quartet out there a little bit more.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, so Pizza Express, exactly. 22nd of August, we're going to be there. We'll probably have a couple of special guests, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
Fun things. But it's actually Tom Farmer on that gig. Tom Farmer is taking the bass chair for that one gig.
Cool.
which is great because obviously Tom and Shane played many years together in Empirical.
Yeah.
That's their thing, you know. So I couldn't be happier about that, really, you know. So yeah, I'm really excited about that gig. Tickets are on sale now.
Sweet.
Get your tickets now. Come on, party people. Yeah. So I think, you know, that's the lineup that I would be looking to do another record with. I think that's my next venture with those guys. Because we've done a couple of gigs. I don't know, you know, if anybody listening, we did a couple of nights at Ronnie's with that quartet and it was really great. They play their butts off, those guys. So it was really cool. Yeah, it was really great.
Butts off jazz.
Yeah.
That's what you want. That's what you get with Freddie every time.
Well, you know, the guy knows how to do it.
He knows all about the jazz scores.
He's got it down.
Man. Well, Rachel, thanks so much for coming on the Jazz Podcast.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for listening to my crazy ramblings and the
rubbish. It's been incredible.
And the sandcastles. And
it's been a real experience. I feel like I've been on an actual journey.
Well, man, I was glad to be there with you. Thanks a lot for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Well, we shall speak to you soon. We'll keep an eye out for the album, the pizza thing.
I'll
make sure that we actually put this show out before those gigs so that
that would be
really, otherwise my media skills are all for nothing. Yeah, right. Removing all this stuff that's now in the past.
Bad promo.
Very bad. Very poor skills indeed.
All right. Well, thank you, Rob. It was nice to speak to you.
You too. And we shall speak to you soon.
Great.
Marvelous. Take care.
Bye. Enjoy.
Bye. Well done.
Well, Rob.
Those dropouts were as amusing as I hoped. It still works. You can. It's still a show.
You think?
Yeah. It's just an adventure in being with Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
It's like how I want all the shows to feel, which is that you're there like a fly on the wall in secret.
Or a fly in the garden.
A fly in the bin truck.
Hmm.
Yeah. Pretty exciting. So next week is George Crowley.
Oh, yeah. Bit of Crowley.
Things are really panning out in a very neat and accurate way at the moment. They don't normally do this. But if my calculations are correct, I believe that the 4th of August will be George Crowley. The 11th of August will be Brigitte Bardot. The 18th of August will be John Halliwell. The 25th of August will be Chris Montague. The 1st of September will be Liam Noble. That is
a nice little week, few weeks of lineup.
Yes, but don't hold me to it because only three of those five interviews are done.
Right.
I was going to do Chris Montague yesterday and my washing machine flooded. And it was a guitar pick stuck in the filter.
It was a guitar pick?
Yeah.
You don't even play guitar.
Well, not well, but, you know. I do like to noodle around three or four chords from time to time.
Right. And you managed to... Right, okay.
Yeah, learn some Coldplay songs. I've got some...
got some chops down here.
Heavy chops, indeed. Alex Monk even gave me a few lessons on...
Well, have you got your guitar to hand?
Unfortunately, no. I had to...
Sat in the washing machine.
It's very high up away from the floodwaters.
Right.
But I thought there was a nice irony to the fact that Chris Montague, being a guitarist, his interview was emergency stopped by a flood. Yeah, very exciting times on the Summer of the Jazz podcast.
Yeah, it's all kicking off.
It certainly is. So next week, we'll be back, 4th of August, with George. In the meantime...
doing anything the next week?
It's the Manchester Jazz Festival.
Of course it is. Yes. So you're working for
us. I'll be there. I'll actually be there to watch and listen and play. And I'm going to wear my nice big Jazz Podcast t-shirt, which has the words Jazz Podcast on in huge letters. So if anyone wants to come and talk to me, I would definitely be open to a few minutes of conversation. If you're confused about everything that's being said, there's a Manchester Jazz Festival preview show from the 14th of July, which previews all the gigs I shall be attending. Really, it should be called the Robco Reality Show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah.
Big time.
I like it. Yeah. I think more people might listen if it was just Robco Reality Show.
Yeah. Maybe I'll just start like doing a live radio feed of my entire days.
I'd listen. Well, I'll be honest, I wouldn't listen for long.
You could tune in and out if there's nothing going on, like a Big Brother radio show featuring me. Be cool. And of course, the big one, 1st of August, I'm going to apologise to Gwilym for deleting his interview.
Ah.
So if there's no show next week, then he killed me.
I'll be taking over.
Yeah, he's going to do some prepared piano with me as the, you know, stuff that's on the strings.
Tied up with the piano strings.
Yeah.
Piano wire.
That's the stuff.
Great. Right, I look forward to it.
Yes. Well, good luck. Lance, it's been
I'm
a
off
pleasure.
To Devon now.
Oh, me too tomorrow.
Oh, you're going? Where are you going?
I don't remember, but one of my friends is getting married.
Oh, lovely. On a Tuesday. No, it's a Friday.
It's Thursday today. Yeah, that's the one. Why Devon? What's going on?
Holiday.
Sweet. Well, we're on the Fine Friends map, so I'll keep an eye out for you.
Oh,
tomorrow.
Yeah, keep an eye out where I end up.
Sweet. Let's go for a coffee and ruin your holiday.
Well, ruin your wedding.
Perfect. Either way, everyone's a winner. All right.
Let's do it. Have a good week.
Let's do it.
Well, maybe see you tomorrow.
Yeah, great. See you tomorrow in Devon. Farewell. You've been listening to the Jazz Podcast, and we'll see you on Friday.
Bye.
Who's that?
Rob Cope.
Why would you say that?
Rob Cope of the Jazz Podcast.
He's going to Devon.
See?
Yeah.
Quite remarkable.